Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Now, the coaching carousel in the NFL is wild. All right, let me start right here. It was back in November that Panthers owner David Tepper made it very clear he was not happy. He was really, really not happy. Carolina had just lost to the Atlanta Falcons 29-3. They fell to 5-5. He let everybody know at that point that was not okay, that he was not going to accept that. He had a conversation with the media, and while the conversation was for context only, and he did not want to be quoted directly, he said the first thing he cares about is winning. He also made it clear the second thing he cares about is winning. The third thing he cares about is winning. He also made it pretty clear he does not like mediocrity. He does not like mediocrity without an ending. And here's the one time that he did go on the record. Tepper said during that session, quote, "Every time we have a loss, my mood is bleepy." End of quote. So a few weeks after that, he made the move to move on from Ron Rivera. That's how much losing bothered him. He was moving on from a head coach who is pretty much universally respected, but Tepper wanted a change. Now compare that, for instance, with what Jerry Jones has done. Compare that with Jerry Jones's approach to mediocrity. Tepper seems to be disgusted and enraged by it. Jones, on the other hand, seems to be just fine with mediocrity. I mean, they're barely over 500 since the year 2000. Jason Garrett had three straight seasons of 8-8 and kept coming back the following year. Hell, if the word mediocrity came to life, it would be Jason Garrett on the sideline clapping his ass off. So no wonder David Tepper and Jerry Jones went about their coaching searches in different manners. Tepper moved on from Rivera during the season so he could get a head start on a new head coach. Didn't even wait until the end of the season. Jones, on the other hand, let his guy twist for an entire week, had himself a sleepover, and then he got around to making a decision. Tepper gets Matt Rhule. Jones gets Mike McCarthy. So if David Tepper's mood is pretty bleepy when he loses, it must be pretty damn good right now because he won. He got over. He got the guy who nobody thought would be his guy. Now, that's not to say that Matt Rhule is guaranteed to be a success in Carolina. I'm not going to say he's a surefire lock to have a better record in Carolina than Mike McCarthy will in Dallas. I mean, there are a lot of coaches who've had success in college and then flamed out in the NFL. Because what it takes to be a great college coach and what it takes to be a great NFL coach are different things. The players are different. How you get players is different. The job is different. Now, Rhule has had a taste of the NFL. He got it as an assistant with the Giants under Tom Coughlin. He learned from that time. He's obviously a really bright guy, and he's not coming in completely blind. He's interviewed for NFL head coaching jobs before. He knows it's different. I would argue Rhule has done a brilliant job of setting this all up. Again, I'm not saying this guy is a stone-cold lock for success. Carolina has got some decisions they've got to make, starting with the one at quarterback. But I'm going to say this. Well, let me say this first. I hope this guy brings that smock with him because the NFL needs more signature looks on the sideline like that. But the thing is, he was supposed to rock that smock in New York. He was supposed to be the Giants guy. This was supposed to be a matter of doing a courtesy interview with the Panthers and then getting on to New York where he'd sign the line that was dotted and he'd be their new head coach. And it all made sense, right? He's from New York. He had already been an assistant in New York. The reporting had always been that if he was going to leave college for the NFL, it was going to be for New York. But he never even got there because Tepper and his team must have done something pretty exceptional, something pretty aggressive, something pretty impressive to keep Rhule from getting on a plane and going to New York to interview because that never actually happened. And the fact that Rhule has got all this leverage and roots in New York and used to work for that team and still didn't even think it was worth the trouble to get on a plane to talk to the Giants tells you all you need to know about Tepper and his ability to close. And it tells you all you need to know about how jacked up the Giants are. you know, once the league's model of stability and respect. And they couldn't even get a college coach who used to work for them to come in and talk with them. Like, never mind taking the job, they couldn't even get this guy to talk to them about the job. So, exactly how the hell did Carolina get this guy? What just happened? How did Carolina pull this off? And just as importantly, what the hell are the Giants going to do right now? You know, about an hour ago, I was thinking to myself, do they even have a plan B? Because they weren't supposed to lose this race. Hell, it wasn't even supposed to be a race. I'm sure the Panthers, or I'm not sure they've ever looked better, but I know the Giants have never looked worse. Again, getting over and getting Rule does not guarantee success, but Tepper comes off like a guy who had a plan. When he moved on from Rivera, he worked that plan, he found the guy he wanted, and he wouldn't let him go. So enough of this nonsense that once Jerry Jones gets to the sleepover phase, he's not losing his new love. Yeah, like Mike McCarthy was ever going to say no to the Cowboys. That doesn't make Jera some badass closer. That deal was not hard to close. Tepper, though, locking Rule up before he could even talk to the Giants is impressive. It tells you a hell of a lot about Tepper. And what's that say about the Giants? Yeah, not much. Not much at all. Because for as weird as the Cowboys coaching situation was, the Giants has been even more bizarre. Now they're looking at their third head coach in 5 years. Their GM has taken all sorts of heat for just about everything, and now they've lost their guy to the Panthers. The only less inspiring choice than Mike McCarthy in Dallas would be Jason Garrett in New York. And I love it. I want it to happen. Except apparently it's not going to happen. It's not. You know what the Giants are? They're like the new Triple U. Uninspired, unimaginative, uncreative. Add to it unoriginal, uninventive, unexceptional, and crappy. Bunch of U's and one C. Come on, Giants fan. Think about this. You've got a possible franchise quarterback in Daniel Jones. You've got a possible generational back in Saquon Barkley if you use him correctly. You've got the fourth pick in the NFL draft. You've got enormous cap space, but you couldn't even get a sit down with a dude who once worked for you. What the hell is wrong here? But at least you are ramping up the analytics and the technology department, right? I'll give you that, Getz. You know, the IT guy, the computer guys. Or maybe the Giants do have their man. Maybe they had another guy in mind all along. Maybe their man is Patriots wide receiver coach Joe Judge. It's great. Maybe they didn't want Matt Rule. Here's a tweet from Adam Schefter. Quote, New York Giants are finalizing a deal to make Patriots wide receiver coach Joe Judge their next head coach. League sources tell ESPN. Deal was in the works as of last night, which is another reason why Matt Rule took the Panthers head coaching job. Well, I know that Judge is a name that had come up for the Mississippi State job. I know that Judge has been making a name for himself, and I don't want to judge a coach by one game or even one season. But did you see... What did you see from the Patriots wide receivers this year that made you think, man, that's our guy. We got to lock this guy up. Let's give this guy the key to our franchise. Like, if anything, the reason the Patriots are not playing this coming weekend is because of their receivers. Like, if you wanted Josh McDaniels, I get that. But instead, you get a guy who worked for McDaniels coaching one of the weak spots, one of the liabilities on that team. And not only that, but you really want everybody to know that that deal was in the works last night, which is why Matt Rule took the Panthers head coaching job. All right. Awesome. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You had a deal with Judge last night, which is why Rule took the Carolina job. So what we're led to believe then is you stiffed Rule. He didn't stiff you. Rule had to go with the second choice, Carolina, because he was your second choice after Joe Judge. In other words, he didn't snub you, you snubbed him. But you didn't announce it until after everybody was all over Rule going to Carolina. Okay, I got it. Makes perfect sense. And the guy you wanted all along was not the guy who had been your assistant in the past, who had had success with two different college programs. It's the guy who was coaching one of the worst units in the NFL. But that's the guy you wanted all along, not the guy everybody thought you wanted all along. All right. Great. If it works for you. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Then don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned is sweetened with a touch of brown sugar goodness, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy for those of you who like to take things up a notch. So, the next time you want a great protein, an energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Michael Porter Jr. is my guest. Michael, it's good to have you back. What's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, really good. Nice to have you back. So let me start here. The team is coming off a win last night, Michael, where Nikola Jokic went for a career-high 47. He had 8 rebounds. He had 5 assists. He did not turn it over. So starting there, how impressed were you with what you saw by him, and what's it like when the big man's having a night like that?
Man, he was dominant last night. We've all been waiting on that, just for him to take over a game, and that's exactly what he did last night, coming off that loss in Washington. So we were all proud of him, and we were happy for him.
Michael Porter Jr. is my guest. You know, I mentioned some of your numbers at the top. When you and I spoke shortly after you were drafted, you had spent last season working your way back from injury. So what was that time like for you? And then how good does it feel to be back on the court and contributing the way you are now?
Man, it feels amazing. Honestly, I'm just so thankful. Got God to thank. It was some dark days, but, man, just being back on the court, it's so amazing. And, to be a part of this really good team, it's something special.
Michael Porter Jr. is my guest. You know, I'm going to ask you about the dark days in a minute, but I want to ask you about your head coach, Michael Malone, because I had him on the show recently, and he was talking about what it's like seeing your potential turn into reality. There's a story that back before the season, the two of you had a meeting, and he said that if you're not playing right away, just stay with me, keep grinding, stay hungry. So how did you go about staying patient and trusting the process?
You know, honestly, I just try to remember, whatever God's plan is, nobody can stop. So whatever his plan was for me, there was no reason to stress about it. It would happen in due time as long as I did my part, and that's having a good attitude, staying humble, staying hungry, just like Coach had said. So, that's what I've tried to do, and I'm starting to get a little bit more opportunity now, and it's great.
All right, so when you go back to a late December game against Sacramento, you finally got that first NBA start. In fact, it was your first start of any kind in a really long time. What kind of emotions were you feeling before that start, and then how good did it feel to come up with 19 points and 6 rebounds the way you did in that start?
I was a little nervous, but I felt pretty good. My energy was high. I was ready to get going. And for me, it felt pretty natural. That's what I've done my whole life. And, just to go straight from warm-ups to the game, it felt pretty good. And so it was really fun for me, and I hadn't had that feeling in a while, so it was good.
Talking to Michael Porter Jr. once again. It'd be pretty easy to focus on your offensive numbers, but as you know, if you're going to play for Michael Malone, you got to play defense, and you've been really focused on the defensive end of late. What's the biggest key for you playing defense in the NBA?
Honestly, you just got to be locked in. Like, I went from thinking about scoring, thinking about how I can help the team in scoring, to thinking about how I can help the team defensively, because that's what's going to keep you on the floor. So if I want to play, I got to play defense. So I really had to change my mindset and be doing all the little things to try to stay on the floor and not worry about buckets, because that'll come.
Then Thursday night, you were back in Indiana against the Pacers, and you played on a court where you first played in fourth grade. You went for 11 for 12 from the field. You had 25 points. You had 5 rebounds. You had an assist in 23 minutes, and you led the team back from a double-digit deficit for the win. I mean, how special was that night for you?
Man, honestly, it was so crazy. I had a lot of my childhood friends at the game. A lot of people there supporting me, and that's the first NBA court I've ever played on, so I felt comfortable for some reason. And I went out there and had a pretty good game. So it was good to see a couple shots fall like that.
Hey, Michael, it's one thing to have like friends and family, even your head coach, have your back. But then after the game, you got this post-game water celebration. It seemed like the guys were so pumped for you. What's it mean to you to have earned the respect and the love from the guys in your own locker room and that they have your back?
You know, it goes a long way. This is to show the kind of team we got. We don't have a lot of guys who are jealous, thinking about themselves. You know, when one guy has success and everybody's happy for him, I think that's big time. And that was probably the best feeling about that whole thing, is just that my teammates were happy for me too.
We're talking to Michael Porter Jr. So we talked about the last few games where you're getting more and more opportunities and you're making the most of them. During the run of six games, you've been getting those minutes and contributing. And now, Michael, you hear the phrase, Michael Porter Jr. has arrived. You hear that a lot now. Is that the way it feels to you on the court? Do you feel like you've arrived, or do you feel like maybe this is just the start?
No, I think this is the very tip of the iceberg. You know, I'm still healing from my past injuries. I feel good, but I'm not all the way there yet. But I feel good, and so it's dope. But I think that this is just tip of the iceberg for me.
Michael Porter Jr. joining me for a few more moments. You know, when you and I started today, you talked about there were some dark times. What were the dark times like, and how did you push through them?
You know, it was just some days, man, where it was like, dang, am I ever going to get over this? Like, am I ever going to play at a high level again? Like, when I had that second surgery sitting on the hospital bed, like, man, I was questioning a lot of things. Like, what's my plan for my life? Like, and it was just crazy. But, you know, who really helped me was my family. And then Isaiah Thomas and Jared Vanderbilt, they were both doing rehab at the same time I was doing rehab. And just for us to all be able to do it together and to see how Isaiah Thomas was attacking his rehab every day, it really inspired me. So,
you know, I would imagine that, like, you go through something like that, maybe you retreat, maybe you focus on yourself, but from the outside, it seemed like you really did get locked in and you went to school on everything about what it takes to be a professional, like how to recover after games, how the NBA game is different. So what did you learn over the course of last year as you did that rehab?
Oh, man, I was just trying to observe. Like, I would observe Isaiah Thomas. You know, he was in a really tough spot because, you know, he missed that contract by a little bit, and then he was in Denver and not playing and trying to rehab, and just seeing his optimism every day and just attacking the rehab, and, you know, it was a slow grind for him. Seeing that, seeing how Paul Millsap recovered after games, being at the age he is, you know, seeing Nikola's approach to the game. I was just trying to observe and learn how to be a professional.
Michael, one thought about Isaiah, you mentioned him a couple of times. Any idea, like, if you had to get inside of his head, if you're Isaiah Thomas and you do whatever you can for the team and you think it's going to pay off and you get that huge payday and then you just miss it, how do you shake something like that? How do you get beyond that? How do you maintain a positive mindset? How do you think he did that?
Honestly, I know that hurt him a lot. But at the end of the day, man, life happens. You know, you got to stay positive, because if not, like, it could break you. So I think for him, he's just a strong individual, and he just let that motivate him. You know, his injury is pretty serious, but he's overcome it. He's playing again. I saw a tweet somewhere where he said he got his joy back, so I'm happy for him. But, I mean, it's tough things that happen.
You know, I would imagine when you look around that locker room right now, you see a team that won 54 games last year, advanced in the playoffs. I mean, that's a really strong roster, and then you come back and you make it even stronger. So when you look at the talent in your locker room right now, what's the upside? How good can this team be?
Man, I think we have a championship-level team, and especially when everybody's clicking and playing for each other. There's no telling how good we could be. And there's a lot of guys on the bench right now that could be playing in a lot of different places, and they're being selfless and still cheering on the team, and, you know, we appreciate that as well. So we got a dope team, man.
You do have a dope team, and I think you got a dope head coach. One last thought: this is a big Michael Malone house right here. Michael, what's it like to play for him?
It's great, man. He pushes me, and I appreciate that. I think in the long run, this slow process for me is going to make me the best player I could be. So I appreciate him. I appreciate how he's brought me along, and the confidence he's tried to give me. So
I want to go back and talk more about the coaching carousel. Like, I look forward to hearing how the Panthers search played out. How did they end up with a guy who grew up in New York City, who had been an assistant with the Giants? How did they get that guy to choose them over the Giants? And how did they do that as quickly as they did? Carolina got him to make a decision really quickly. You know, and again, the speculation or the noise coming from New York would have you believe that, oh no, that's not who we wanted. the reason he made that decision so quickly to go to Carolina is because he knew we didn't want him. Oh, okay. Yeah, that or David Tepper must have said something, did something, broke out his checkbook, all the above, but he did something serious enough to get this guy to commit and to keep him off an airplane and keep him out of the Apple. But even then, whatever Tepper said, whatever Tepper did, it can't be nearly as wild as how the Cowboys ended up with Mike McCarthy. Let me bounce over to that for a minute. Yesterday, we learned about that sleepover they had on Saturday night. And that was just as bizarre as you might expect. Look, I'm not saying that Jerry Jones can't have house guests, although I doubt the two of them were napping it out on air mattresses in the living room, smashing pizza, and making crank phone calls. Thank you. Crank, crank, crank. Hey, look, I'm sure that Jerry has got a guest wing at his house. I'm sure that Jerry has a guest house at his house. I'm sure Jerry has a guest house with its own guest house. I get this. He probably has a mansion that sleeps several hundred or a thousand. But man, it's still weird. It's still weird as hell that he was having a sleepover with a head coaching candidate while he still had a head coach. I'd love to know how many times Jason Garrett slept over. I wonder if they made those funny little forts and hung out for the sleepovers. Anyway, there's a report from PFT saying that a source with knowledge of the dynamics between Jones and McCarthy said it was, quote, like love at first sight, end quote. Love at first sight between some old billionaire and some unemployed middle-aged coach. Like, how's that work? Like, you had me at circumcised mosquito, Michael.
Circumcising the mosquito.
You had me at circumcised mosquito, Michael.
Circumcising the mosquito.
I mean, I'll say it. I said it before. I'll say it again right now. The hell is going on here? Grandpa is having sleepovers and fell in love with the dude who just slept over at first sight. Man, that's weird. Even for Jera, that's weird. Next level weird. And again, I don't mean any disrespect by this. Now, generally, when somebody says, I don't mean any disrespect by this, somebody's about to get disrespected. Not in this case. I don't mean any disrespect by this, but it's Mike McCarthy. We're talking about a guy with a good record for most of his career, a guy who does have a Super Bowl ring, but as smart and as sharp as he is, does anybody think that he's the smartest guy around? I mean, he's got a really good football mind. But he never came across as Mr. Personality in Green Bay. But to hear the reports, Jera was absolutely blown away by this guy. Absolutely infatuated with this guy. Like, Jera didn't just give this guy a rose. He gave him all the roses. Jera loved that Saturday night sleepover so much that on Sunday, he fired Jason Garrett. So Jera didn't just like Mike. He fell for Mike. He didn't just fall for Mike. He fell hard for Mike. And if I'm being honest, I don't really get it. I do not get it. Like, don't get me wrong. I don't hate the hiring of Mike McCarthy. Again, he's had success. He's got that ring. He's had a lot more success than the Cowboys have had. And he's won in Dallas. He's beaten the Cowboys. So apparently that meant something to a lot of people. Like, I don't hate it. I just don't love it. I can't get fired up about it. I can't get hyped about it. It's kind of like, meh. I mean, it's fine. I'd expect that he'd be something of an upgrade over Jason Garrett. But bottom line, does it really fix what ails the Cowboys? Does it make the Cowboys Super Bowl contenders? Because that's what Jerry thinks. Jerry thinks that he compiled a roster good enough to win a Super Bowl, but they didn't get it done. So he fired his coach. He let him twist for a whole week, but he fired his coach. So does hiring Mike McCarthy make them Super Bowl contenders? Yeah, I mean, they're probably the favorites in the NFC East. But then again, they should have already won the NFC East this year. So that's not a big change. No, the bigger question is this. Are they going to beat teams like the 49ers and the Seahawks? And the real painful question, are they going to beat the Packers? because it sure seems like the Packers got a hell of a lot better when McCarthy left. Now, I know a lot of that's about the change in approach to free agency and the fact that they brought in the Smiths and Adrian Amos, but it's a pretty rough look to hire a guy who got fired at 4-7-1 only to have that same team go on and play to 13-3 the next year. Like, if I'm a GM, I'm not sure I'm falling in love with that. But old man Jarrett sure did. So, when you look at what the Cowboys' problems were, does McCarthy fix them? The offense was pretty good. They put up some crazy numbers. But the biggest issue was discipline and energy. And by the end of his time in Green Bay, one of the criticisms of McCarthy was a lack of discipline and a lack of energy. And then how about that report from Tyler Dunn back in April about McCarthy getting massages in his office during the final prep meeting on Saturdays? Also kind of weird, kind of awkward. Does that feel like a guy who's going to come in and address what ails the Cowboys? Maybe, possibly, pretty hard to say, but really hard to get excited about. Just like it's kind of hard to get excited about his offense, because the biggest rap on McCarthy was that his offense was stale, that it was bland, that it was boring, that it was predictable, that it was unimaginative. You know, that in an era where guys like Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay were changing the game with their schemes, but McCarthy had not changed. And it's not like offense was the problem in Dallas in the first place. Again, he could make that offense better. But the fact that Jerry Jones, McCarthy, wants Kellen Moore to stay tells you something about the offense. And when Carolina gets the cooler, buzzier, splashier hire than the Cowboys, that tells you something too. And by the way, let's not forget, when Carolina beats the Giants to their man, that also tells you a lot. So here's what it comes down to with the Cowboys. Mike McCarthy is a good coach, but from the sounds of it, Mike McCarthy was not hired because he's a Super Bowl coach. He was hired because Jarrah likes him. And because he's not going to fight Jerry. He's not going to force Jerry to change. That's the bottom line. Jerry Jones, the CEO, thinks Jerry Jones, the GM, is doing a hell of a job, and he does not want to change that job. And from the sounds of it, McCarthy's not going to ask him to. That's why he got that job. Not because he's the best guy. Bob Huggins is my guest. Hey, Hawk, are you going to pull him up or am I? Hug, Happy New Year. What's going on, Bob?
Romy, how are you?
Hug, I'm so good. How are you?
Well, good. Been a while. I haven't talked to you in years.
Has it been years?
I think so.
It's been a few minutes.
Lose track of time.
I know, we do, don't we? Hey, listen, I want to ask about the team, Bob, but again, let me reset this. How are you doing? How is life for you in 2020?
Good. Really good, other than I can't get rid of this cold, but other than that, good.
Yeah, right? Like, you think they could figure out a cure for the common cold by now, but no. Do you do about a cold, usually? How do you hit that thing?
I don't know. The doctor's been giving me stuff, but just hanging on.
What are you going to do? Bob Huggins joining us.
Our defense, I guess.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to talk about defense. You held Oklahoma State to just 19 points, Bob, in the first half, 22 in the second half. So not only did you play excellent defense, but it seems to me you were pretty strong on the glass. You stayed in front of your man on defense. Guarding the ball has always been a focal point. So how pleased were you with the guys and how they were able to impact that game with defense and rebounding?
Well, I think the really good thing is that, you know, we've got a lot of new guys. We've got a lot of young guys. We're basically a really young team of pretty much freshmen and sophomores. And they've come a long way in a short period of time. So, you know, as we keep continuing to improve at the defensive end and start making some shots, we just haven't made any shots. I think we're very capable of making shots. We just haven't made any.
Bob Huggins back in the jungle. And Bob, that game came after a tough game in Lawrence on Saturday where, like you said, you probably missed some more shots than you would have liked. The officiating, Bob, was, well, it's kind of interesting. So what did you make of how the team bounced back from that game and made sure that one loss did not turn into two?
Well, we had the good fortune of staying out there. So we didn't have, you know, it wasn't like we played and came home and then had to go back out there. So we spent a lot of time watching film and trying to learn, trying to point out some things that we could certainly do better. And I thought really defensively we made great strides out there. And I think it was, you know, all the film that we did.
Bob Huggins joining us. You know, Bob, that game in Kansas is part of a run which includes a non-conference win over number 2 Ohio State, the trip to Lawrence, then Stillwater, and now you've got Texas Tech at home on Saturday. The Big 12 is always a meat grinder. So what's it take in terms of physical and mental toughness to have success in that conference?
Well, I think all of that, and I think you have to be fortunate, you know. You gotta make shots at the right time. You gotta hope that sometimes they miss shots at the right time. And you know, we've struggled at the free throw line, and that shouldn't be, because we've made a conscious effort to go out and recruit some guys who could shoot, and we've really struggled at the free throw line. If we make free throws, we're probably undefeated right now.
West Virginia is top 20 right now. Bob Huggins joining us. You know, Bob, last season maybe did not go the way you would have liked. And I heard you say coming into the season, quote, I wanted guys that wanted to play hard, guys that wanted to win. We can help them with the other stuff, end quote. So, like, when you think of some of the guys you've had, guys like Javon Carter, how did you know they wanted to win as badly as you do?
Well, we tried to do a good job of, you know, watching them play on their team, watching them play in the summertime. You know, but you don't really get to watch them enough. I just thought we had really good people. I thought our returning guys did a great job on the school visit of spending a lot of time with them, trying to explain to them what we're trying to do, and then giving us good information back about who they thought would be a good fit. And, Romy, I think that's more than anything. I mean, we got guys that like each other, that pull for each other. I mean, you can't find another team playing 12 guys and they're all happy. You know, somebody's going to pout, somebody's going to want to quit because they're not getting as much time as maybe they think they ought to get. But our guys they like each other so much that they pull so much for each other, and care about each other, and play hard together.
That's got to make you feel good. Bob Huggins joining us. Now, Hug, one more thing about that. Like, if you've got a guy who's got a ton of potential, and you know this, but you're not sure, or maybe he doesn't have that burning desire to play hard and to win, is that something that you can fix, or do you just move on from that and go to a guy who's got that fire?
I think you can fix it as long as you've got guys on your side. You know, the other guys are on your side. I think it's pretty easily fixed. It's when you got a kind of a rat in the house that's, pulling in the other direction and trying to take as many people with them as they possibly can. And that happens.
I like that. A rat in the house. Kind of reminds me of John Calipari. Bob, back in the day, who said it's like that pinch of poop in the ice cream. You got this whole bucket of ice cream, and the ice cream's great. All it takes is one pinch of poop to wreck it. Kind of like that one rat in the house, right? Doesn't matter how big that house is. All it takes is one rat to recruit the other rats.
Yeah, only Cal could come up with poop in the ice cream.
Is it true, too? Bob Huggins joining us. Let me ask you about Oscar Tshiebwe. He came in with a lot of buzz. He had 12-8 last night, 17-17, Bob, against Kansas. He had 20-17 in the second game of the season against Pitt. What do you make of what you've seen from him so far?
Well, obviously he's a talented guy, but he's a guy who wants to get better. I mean, he's in the gym. He's coming in watching film on his own. He just tries to absorb everything that you tell him. He's a guy who really wants to be great, and it's refreshing. He's in the gym on his own. You know, when he came in, he really couldn't make jump shots from the foul line, you know, 15, 17 feet. He's worked really hard on that to where he can make jump shots now. He's gotten better from the free throw line. He's passing the ball better. He's guarding better. He could always rebound it. He could always rebound it and run and score in the post, but he's really, I think, made his game so much better in so many other areas.
We're talking to Bob Huggins for a few more moments. You know, Bob, he can dominate. We know this, and he's still getting better, but this is not a one-man team. As an example, against Ohio State, Oscar played just 8 minutes, and you still beat the number 2 team in the country. So what's it say about your depth with this squad?
Well, Derek Culver's pretty good. Oscar's good, and Derek's very good. They're both big, strong guys, and they both rebounded. Derek had 12 rebounds last night again. And then we bring guys off the bench. We bring guys off the bench that play hard. They're not, you know, maybe as skilled as those other two guys or as offensively potent, but we bring a 6'11", 260-pound, 5-year guy off the bench, and we bring another 6'7", whatever, 240-pound guy off the bench that really can move his feet and really guard. So, you know, with four bigs, we're pretty comfortable playing the way we play.
You've got Texas Tech, Bob, coming in this weekend, and you know what you're going to get when you take on the Red Raiders and a Chris Beard coach team. In fact, I was in Lubbock over the summer. I spent some time with him. When you look at what Chris Beard has done right there at Texas Tech, what kind of thoughts do you have, and what kind of a challenge does his team generally pose?
Well, Chris has done a great job. I think a lot of what he does comes from Coach Knight, having spent all that time with Coach Knight. But, you know, their motion is really good. They get really good shots out of that. They're very patient with it. And defensively, they got 10 eyes on the ball all the time. They do a great job of help. You know, you don't have to beat one of them. You got to beat like three or four of them because they're all lined up there in help position. Chris has done a terrific job, and he's done a great job of getting players there. I guess my question for you is, how'd you fit in Lubbock?
So well. It's like I grew up there. You could not believe how I took to Lubbock and how Lubbock took to me. It was incredible, Hug. You sound like you're surprised.
I can imagine those folks in Lubbock just fell in love with you from the minute they saw you.
It was incredible. They claim me as one of their own, Hug. Like, I'm walking up and down the street, and people are coming up to me like, yo, Rome, you're from here, right? You're from here. I'm like, of course I'm from here. You know this about me. They love me, and I love them. You know this, Bob.
Did you have a cowboy hat and boots on?
No, I didn't even need one. I don't even need one, but it would not have been hard to get one or both of the above. It was incredible. Lubbock lived up to all the hype. I loved it, man. I loved
good.
It. I know you're not surprised.
No.
Bob Huggins, my guest. Hey, Hug, before you go on, a serious note. Over the weekend, Chuck Mayshock passed away, and you and Chuck are way, way back to when you were in high school, and you said, quote, he was the one who I called when I needed an answer, end quote. What was he like as a person? What kind of an impact did he have on you?
He's a great person. He's a great person, a very caring person, a basketball guy through and through. He was like a second father to me. I mean, Coach Gardner's staff got let go at West Virginia, and I got let go with him. I was part of the staff. The first person I called was Chuck. And Chuck immediately said, let me go talk to Coach Miller, and talked to Coach Miller, and I think he had everything to do with me getting hired at Ohio State and spending a couple of years at Ohio State and learning from Chuck and Elton Miller. So, I mean, my whole career, really, I owe to him. I mean, he's been there every step of the way. I went to Florida with him, to Central Florida, to try to get that program going. The first person I talked to when I took the Cincinnati job was Chuck about coming and helping. If you seen anything that our guys, our former players say, it's nothing but total admiration for Chuck as a coach, but more importantly, Chuck as a person.
Appreciate your thoughts on that. Bob Huggins joining us, the head basketball coach of West Virginia, nearly 900 wins now as a head coach. They're number 17 in both polls. They're 12-2. Another big one coming up on Saturday night. They're at home against Texas Tech. Hug, happy New Year. So good to have you back in the jungle, Bob. I appreciate it.
Happy New Year to you. Don't wait like 4 years to call me back again, please.
The sports media world has got this fascination with The Bachelor. And y'all know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Websites with power rankings and brackets for each season. Sports talk radio shows that devote an entire segment to talking about it. I mean, it's weird. I don't really get it. I've never told somebody else how to do their show. I'm not going to start right now because I don't want you telling me how to do my show. But that's something I've never really understood. And by the way, I'm not ashamed to say it's weird and I don't get it. In fact, I'm pretty content not getting it and not doing segments recapping it. Except last night was a pretty big night. Season 24. Way too many, by the way. Season 24 premiered with a 3-hour episode. Way too long. And while that was obnoxiously trending 15 different ways on Twitter, Another more interesting Bachelor-related storyline was developing, and this one actually does have sports ties. For once, a former contestant on that show from 5 years back, somebody named Jade Roper Tolbert, made news because over the weekend, she won a fantasy football contest on DraftKings and pocketed a cool $1
million. $1
million. Pretty damn sweet, right? Like, as an aside, really quickly, I was getting my ass kicked over the weekend, getting down. I'm not going to lie, I made one last-ditch effort at the end of the weekend to get right, and I did, and it felt awesome. Let's just say me getting right amounted to about $999,900 less than what she did. And I felt pretty damn good. I can only imagine how Jade felt. Pretty damn sweet. Well done. Like, how was your weekend, everybody else not named Jade? Or Van Smack, because I got right at the end. One little problem. I did it legitimately. Jade's little problem, a tiny little annoying problem called cheating and collusion. And that's what Jade Roper Tolbert is being accused of right now, because Jade Roper Tolbert has got two last names, because Jade Roper Tolbert is married. And she is married to Tanner Tolbert, who, you guessed it, was also a contestant on The Bachelor. You know, that classic true love story. Hey, where'd you guys meet? On a reality show, of course, true love. So according to the reports, yeah, like, I don't know the two of them, so I really don't know how in love they are or are not, but they did fall in love on a reality show, right? Anyway, according to the reports, each contestant in the DraftKings $1 million contest was allowed to enter a maximum of 150 lineups into the pool, which is exactly what she did. Now, the giant-ass red flag is that her husband, Tanner, also entered 150 lineups into the pool. The 300 lineups belonging to members of the Tolbert family, and only two of them were identical. Uh-oh! So what's being alleged here is this semi-famous married couple loopholed the system to double their number of unique entries, and thus double their chances of winning the seven-digit payout. According to DraftKings, that is collusion, and that is illegal. And according to everybody else who played in the contest, they are pissed. And now DraftKings has delayed the payout and is launching an investigation to say that they take it extremely seriously. Now, you could argue that nothing in the world is stopping two other anonymous players from trying the exact same thing. I guess you'd be right. The problem here is, the two people that are kind of, but not really famous, well, they did it. And they used their kind of, not really famous, real names to do it. And then they bragged about it online. And it took all of 5 minutes for everybody to scream foul. You know, to me, frankly, I'm shocked that two people who were looking for love on The Bachelor could be so stupid and could want attention so badly. I mean, it's like, my understanding, the contestants on that show are the best and the brightest, and they normally hate the spotlight. They don't want that. They don't want people looking at them. They don't want people talking about them. They don't want to try and get opportunities from that. They're not there for that reason. You know, what makes the whole thing even more fishy is that Tanner is a well-known, high-volume, daily fantasy sports player. His wife is not, at least until this weekend. So you've got a guy who does this on the regular, who all of a sudden has a wife in the game with another 148 unique lineups. And again, neither one of them bothered to enter the contest under aliases or proxies. They just rolled in as the Tolberts. Then they won, and then they pimped it online. How you like us now? I love you two now. How'd you enjoy those 5 minutes of being millionaires? Not exactly Bonnie and Clyde, are they? But then again, who the hell is? So it's unclear what DraftKings will do from here. Because again, how do you police something like that? How can you stop two or more people from getting on the phone and coordinating exactly what those two did? I mean, you probably can't. But if you can't trust two people from The Bachelor to play legit, who can you trust? Obviously, the most shocking thing with this whole story is that two people who were married on The Bachelor 3 years ago are still married. Like, mind blown. Hope you all didn't spend that money yet. Jane Slater is my guest. Jane, what's going on? How are you?
Big fan of this. I've been a fan of your show for a long time. So thank you so much for having me on, Jim.
Jane, it is so good to have you on. I really appreciate it. And it's great to talk to you. In fact, Jane, there's so much that you and I could talk about. But let me start with this. What has it been like for you covering the Dallas Cowboys and the coaching situation, Jane, since the end of the Washington game?
An absolute circus. I worked in news long before I ever did sports. And I've got to tell you, this was the most curious thing that I've covered, mostly because there weren't any leaks coming out of this situation. In other words, Jerry and Steven were playing this so close to the vest that it was hard to get answers out of this organization. I mean, I was feeling like I was chasing down every single ghost leading up to this final decision this week. And even the intel we were getting from inside the building was so curious. But going back to really the Washington game, we thought that a decision had been made. It was clear that they were not going to move on with Jason Garrett, so why not just make that decision after the game? And I'll tell you, the best way I can characterize it was Stephen Jones was livid when I walked off with him as reporters were talking to Jerry Jones, trying to get a feeling and the mood of what Monday would be like, and he wasn't going to talk about it. And my sense was that maybe Jerry got cold feet, or maybe Jerry just wanted this thing to, in fact, expire on January 14th and do right by Jason Garrett. But I thought what was so curious was this reports that we were getting out of the Star that Jason was continuing to show up to the facility as if he was still the head coach. And while he was saying goodbye to players without actually saying goodbye, he was also telling them in meetings, we want you back next year. While a lot of us were trying to figure out, well, how can you say that if you're not coming back? And then add to the layer of intrigue, we were not getting a clear edge on any candidate. I had reported that there had been a meeting between Stephen Jones and Urban Meyer back in October. Without getting into too many specifics, there was a meeting, and I was told that there was a genuine interest. Now, say what you want about this Urban thing. Perhaps Urban was out there having a meeting with him just to consult for the team, and then he was floating out there for interest in the NFL. You never know with Urban Meyer, but that was real. But as for who they were really digging into, I never really bought the Lincoln Riley thing. Matt Rhule felt like a possibility, but a stretch. And you always have to read between the lines when Jerry Jones goes on 105 Through the Fan for his weekly radio show. And he had talked so much about the fact he wanted to coach with head coaching experience, which made more sense to me, because if your window that he's been talking about has been closing for years, why would you roll the dice on a college coach, especially these college coaches who really hadn't won anything yet? So it felt like it was going to be a guy with head coaching experience. But I got to tell you, the Mike McCarthy thing felt like it came out of left field. And I think that he owes Tom Pelissero at NFL Network 10% of this new contract, because Tom put out that piece about him trying to make himself more relevant, deep diving into stats, him and Jimmy Haslett trying to, you know, be old dogs learning new tricks. And I think it worked. I think all of that preparation in the offseason and then getting in a room with Jerry and Steven, I think they ate it up. And I truly believe there was a possibility that if they were not impressed with these candidates, that Jerry basically told Steven there was a way that perhaps Jason could stay. I never believed it was in a GM role, but I felt that McCarthy just wowed them so much that they ended up saying, you know what, this is a guy that has evolved. This is a guy who's got head coaching experience. This is a guy that's won a Super Bowl. This is a guy that won a Super Bowl at AT&T Stadium. We've got to make a move on him before somebody else will. And so that's how this all sort of transpired and went down.
Jane Slater murdering her Jungle debut. Well done, Jane. All right, so you covered the Cowboys during your past season. Jane, what was your sense as to their biggest issue, and how does McCarthy go about addressing that?
You know, I think their biggest issue, honestly, Jim, is accountability. One of the problems that we were seeing with Jason Garrett, I mean, the players loved him. That's something that hasn't changed. The players love his passion, and the guy that you see on the podium is so different than the guy that walks off with you. You know, his joke is always, let's discuss this over a few lemonades. There's always been much more to Jason than what you see. But I think the problem was there were a lot of times that players, Dez Bryant was one of them, David Irving was another, that if they didn't like the message coming from Jerry Jones' the staff, they went straight to Jerry Jones' office, or they went straight to Stephen Jones. And I think you need a coach that comes in here and sort of says, "There's the buck stops here." And I think that Jerry and Stephen will empower Mike McCarthy to do that. I think that Mike's going to be a little bit more of a disciplinarian. And I think because this is such a young group of guys, you know, they finally have done a good job in Dallas for so long. They held on to these aging players. That was one of the big knocks on them. This is a relatively young locker room. I think that they need some order. And so I think if they can get that done, and I think that you're bringing in some guys with some veteran leadership, there'll be a respect level that not necessarily that Jason didn't have. It's just I didn't feel like some of these guys. I mean, I go back to when Ezekiel Elliott got in a car crash a couple of years ago, or, you know, when some of these things would pop up with Vegas, and asking Jason Garrett, "Have you reached out to Ezekiel Elliott yourself?" And his response would be, "No, but but the organization has." Well, why isn't the head coach reaching out? Why isn't the coach calling and saying, you know, "Are you okay, first of all? Yes, there's an accountability deal." When he had gone to David Irving after his concussion 2 years ago, I know that Jason at least tried to tell David Irving, "Hey, you can't be in the club after you've gotten a concussion while we're on the road trying to get a win against the Eagles." So there were just these things that I felt like while he was a good rah-rah guy, there was a process. He respected his consistency. You sort of need a guy that's going to go in there and, I think, hold this locker room accountable, and I think a new voice is going to do that.
Jane Slater is a reporter for NFL Network. Jane, a couple of things before you go. I want to ask you about a conversation you had with Rod Marinelli. And I want to preface this by saying that I do not root. It is my job not to root, but I've got so much respect for Rod. He told you that he doesn't know what he's going to do in the future, but it does not seem like he's going to be in Dallas. And he said, quote, "Only thing I know is they can't send me back to Vietnam. After that, it's cake. Outlook is always forward," end quote. And I absolutely love the man. What was your conversation with him like?
You know, he has become such an incredible mentor in Dallas. You know, when I first got into sports, you, of course, would deal with a lot of guys who, you know, it's still, I mean, 2003 is when I got into this thing. And, you know, you'd still deal with, you know, guys not really feeling like women had a role in the locker room, as ridiculous as that sounds back in 2003. But I feel like it's gotten so much better over the years, and so many young guys are used to seeing us in there. But when I first met Rod Marinelli, I always carry around a notepad with me, and I take vigorous notes while I've got my recorder out, you know, even though I've got a camera and crew there with me. And Rod had always told me how much he respected that I took notes and did it the old school way. And because of that, there were a couple of us that in the just female reporters that covered the team. He has two daughters that he just adores. And he wanted us to get to know his daughters. And his daughter, Gina Marinelli, is a top chef in Las Vegas, and she's in a male-dominated business. And he just really wanted us to be around women who were in careers like that, and then always encouraged us to not only be great, but to do your job the right way. He's not a coach that ever leaked you information. I never got anything from him. What I got was a guy that constantly just motivated me to do the right thing. And if there was something he thought I needed to read up on or be more hip to, like, you know, Tampa 2, understand why that was important to him, he would let me. So when we had our conversation, it was incredibly bittersweet yesterday. He didn't know what his future was. It looked like they were obviously moving on from Mike Nolan after I talked to my sources in New Orleans, and Mike had essentially said his goodbyes to everybody, and one person had said, "It looks like it's as good as done." I got the sense that there's still a possibility he could coach, but I also got the sense that he was okay with his coaching career. And the coolest thing about that guy was he was always supporting the advancement of other coaches, Chris Richard, Matt Eberflus, go down the list. So I have just an immense amount of respect. So do his players. It's unfortunate that his players weren't able to get it done for him. But if you look at his defense prior to this year, he was able to get a lot out of a lot of guys that a lot of people didn't think they could get things out of. And I know that the guys are going to be sad to see him gone, and I certainly am as well.
Appreciate your thoughts on him. Guys love him. I love Rod Marinelli. I haven't spoken to him in quite some time, but I used to love talking to him when he was a head coach, and he was always great on the show. Speaking of the show, Jane, before I let you go, you mentioned it on Twitter, so I guess I would not be doing my job if I did not ask you about it. But how many times, Jane, have you listened to the Toby in Houston call?
So this is a great story. So I did Colin Cowherd's show this summer, and Jason Stewart, one of your producers, was the first guy that greeted me. And I had mentioned how much I love the Jim Rome show, and I sort of fangirled out when I found that he worked on your show. And when he told me the backstory that he was the screener that let that one go, Oh my gosh. It literally was a signature moment in my sports career. It literally felt like everything had come full circle because I have listened to that over and over and over. I did sports talk in Dallas, so I legitimately felt for Jason that he allowed Toby to come and jump on your show. But shout out to Toby in Houston.
Shout out to Toby in Houston. She is an NFL Network reporter. You can follow her on Twitter at SlaterNFL. She just made and crushed her jungle debut. Jane, such a great job. Good to finally have you on the show. Thank you so much. Let's be sure to do it again.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
Kathleen in Omaha. Kathleen, what's your beef?
My beef is with Mr. Luscious-ass Sidney Crosby for not getting his surgery earlier. If that sugar muffin had got it sooner, he wouldn't be missing all this time right now. And the Penguins already lost Jake for the year, and they need Sidney back now rather than later.
Kathleen, the thing is, I mean, it sounds like you have a really high threshold for sugar muffin's pain.
The surgery earlier. I heard he had it. He needed it since training camp.
Surgery.
Why didn't he get it then?
Because you never. Surgery is the last option. You never know what's going to happen with a surgery. Something bad could happen, especially to your little sugar muffin.
He is a sugar muffin
with a luscious ass.
That too.
Thank you. All right, Kathleen. Appreciate your beef. Kathleen in Omaha.
Good night now!